It was pain that knocked upon my door and said that she had come to stay. And though I would not welcome her but bade her go away, she entered in, and like my own shade, she followed after me, and from her stabbing, stinging sword, no moment was I free. There are trials and troubles that just won't go away. They plague us till our wretched souls are battered with adversity. And to some extent, that describes every one of us at some point or points in our lives. All of you have been bruised by adversity if you've lived very long, or you will be. Some of you have been recently. David said, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but it's not just the righteous. Job said, man's days are short-lived, full of turmoil, few and full of trouble. Paul said, we are perplexed, persecuted, knocked down. If we were to trace the journeys of Paul in the first century, it would be like tracing the path of a wounded deer pursued by a hunter, one bloody step after another. Peter said, think it's not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you, because this is the way it is in life. The Bible is replete with illustrations of the reality of hurt and trouble. The drum of man beats out the pulse of pain. A jeweler, I'm told, sometimes gives as one of the tests for a true diamond the water test, because the imitation stone is not as brilliant as the genuine, but sometimes you can't tell by looking. So I'm told that the genuine diamond sparkles even when you put it under the water, while the imitation is practically extinguished as to its sparkle. Whether that's true or not, I can't say for sure, but I do know that in the Christian life, many who are confident of their faith and then find themselves under the water of adversity and trouble find that their faith does not show forth as brilliantly as they had hoped. Whereas when we put true solid faith under the same waters exactly, it shines forth as brilliantly as ever. This is why G.K. Chesterton says, I believe in getting into hot water. I think it keeps you clean. There is the need in our lives for a testing. And sometimes there is no better test than hot water, the water of sorrows and trials. How we handle trouble is an indication of our faith. And we experience it constantly, don't we? Seems like it's never very far away, as it was said in that Messianic 22nd Psalm, be not far from me, for trouble is near me. Job said, man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. And Solomon said, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation. He sure did. And he was troubled in spirit, John 13:21. Paul said, we are troubled on every side, 2 Corinthians 4:8. So we expect trouble. And if you think you're the only one going through it, you just haven't been looking around lately. So how do we face this? If your faith is no good for trouble, it's no good. If it's only good when you don't need it, you don't need it. If my faith is only good when all is well, then it's not well. So James says in the first chapter, verse 2, that statement there about various trials, diverse temptations. The word for various there means variegated, multicolored. It's the expression from which we get our term for polka dotted. It emphasizes the diversity of troubles more than just their number. All the shades, sizes, varieties of troubles. And James says when, not if. Because trials are at least as inevitable as death and taxes. You may not have to die, And in some rare cases, you may not even have to pay taxes. But if you live very long at all, you're going to have trouble. I heard a story about a man on his way home on a subway. And this particular man was somewhat prone to motion sickness to begin with. And he'd had a big lunch that day and then had worked all afternoon with a bit of an upset stomach. And now he was jammed into the subway as the last person able to get on before the door slammed shut. And it was hot, and he was in there with the door closed, and in that doorway facing out, looking through the window, as he looked out at everything whizzing by at 90 miles an hour, he just got sicker and sicker the longer he stood there. Until they came to a stop that was not his place to get off, but another man was waiting on the subway platform to get on. And the door opened, and out came this man's lunch all over the man who was waiting on the platform. And then the door shut, and the train went right on. And the man on the platform, suddenly covered with the other man's lunch, turned around and said to the man standing in line behind him, "Why me?" And isn't that just the way? Doesn't it seem so often that the most unlikely possible things happen? How could you have written the script for this? As a matter of fact, while I was preparing these lessons for this weekend, just a couple of days ago, our little three-year-old came to my door and said, "Daddy, would you like to go out and see if there's any ripe raspberries?" So we went out and began to pick some red raspberries and eat them together. I've done that thousands of times in my life, eaten thousands of raspberries, but on that particular day, I think it was Friday, I picked a red raspberry that looked just like all the others, put it in my mouth. There was either a bee on it or in it because it stung me right on the tongue. Couldn't believe it. And as I was clawing to get the stinger out, my little three-year-old is wide-eyed and looking up at me. I had the sneaking thought that maybe this is the providence of God telling me in some kind of way, if you're going to go up there and talk about trials, you better have a little experience before you get started. And that's really the way it is in life, isn't it? Just time after time. The impulse to ask, why me? Why this? Why now? If the door of the subway doesn't open on you this time, get ready, because it will. It will. And we all know. And these trials do have a purpose. That's the point here in verse 3 of James 1. The trying of your faith worketh patience. The word means endurance. These are specific tests to stretch us spiritually. Trials teach us how to hang in there when it seems like there's really no good answer. We may be in the habit of taking tests as personal offenses that rile us. But if we can begin to look at them as servants to teach us, we'll be way ahead. Our faith is tested the way a rubber band is tested, by stretching, to help us be a little more flexible, to help us give a little where we didn't before. And by, the Lord hopes that we will become patient under the load. So in James 1 and 3, again, the idea of the trying or the testing of your faith. The word for trying or testing there is dokimos, which is the word for approved. Many of the jugs and pots that have been dug up in the old land of Israel are marked on the bottom with that word, dokimos, for approved, expressing approval for a vessel that has gone through the furnace without cracking. The vessels that cracked in the furnace were put up on the budget shelf and sold at a very cheap price. But those that were valuable were those which were approved through the furnace. A swimming instructor works all summer with the children. And at the end of the summer, when the day of testing comes, the instructor puts the little child down into the water, not to see the child sink, not to disapprove the child, but hoping to see the child swim. It's a test. And he hopes that the test is passed successfully. So in that fourth verse of James chapter 1, the statement is made, let patience have her perfect work. Let endurance have its perfect result. Just like stacking up a row of dominoes, which we used to do as children. Then you push the first one over and they all fall down if they're on track. So the first domino, the finger of testing pushes over that first domino. And when endurance goes down, then it begins to bump on to the beginning of maturity, and then it bumps on to greater stages of maturity right down the line. And if maturity stays on course as these dominoes fall throughout your life, you become a person of great, deep character. The great Christian characters whom you and I know are people who have learned how to handle life in the furnace. The mother who is able to say, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The father who has done the very best job that he could on the job and loses his job anyway, who comes home and says to his family, let's thank the Lord for this opportunity to trust him. The teenager who says, I will not give up my principles. I will maintain my standards, even though right now it seems like there's not a person in the world who likes me. This marvelous quality of maturity emerges when we are patient under the load. We can think of troubles then not as an enemy, but as a servant for patience and ultimately for character development unto maturity. How can I rise above my situation? I don't want to drop out. I don't want to quit. I don't want to stop short. What is there that will help me handle troubling situations? How can I become that winner in verse 12 of the first chapter of James, who happily at the end receives the crown of life? When I go through a trial, first of all, I need to examine how I react to that trial and what that reaction says about my faith. What does it say about my love for God? That's the end of verse 12 in James 1, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Those who love God is a title for Christians. The 8th chapter of the Roman letter uses it that way. All things work together for good to them that love God. Them who are the called according to his purpose. The latter phrase explains the first one. And it's referring to Christians. Love holds them fast. If I'm supposed to love God, but I have no ultimate regard except for my own happiness, then I don't really love God supremely, do I? If I delight in God not for what he is, but just for what he is to me, in such a sentiment, there's no real solid virtue. There's a great love of self, but not so much love for God. When God himself becomes the object of devout and delighted contemplation, then the views of the lover of God are in a great measure diverted from self. We're not thinking about self at all. My soul begins to cleave to God. And in the fervor of my affection, that's when I learn to say, whom have I in heaven but thee, like the psalmist did. As the hart pants after the water brook, so pants my soul after thee, O God. The bond that ties us to God is love, not just a superficial affection, not just sentiment that is basically selfish. I'll be here as long as I'm getting something out of it. Then I'll stick around. But a bond of true love that can endure any trial. Let me ask you this. Who do you love more than you love God? Are you pleased with the character of God? Do you love all of it? Do you love his holiness as well as his grace? Do you love his justice as well as his mercy? In whose character do you see more beauty than in the character of God? To whom are you more grateful than you are to God? Supreme love to God is decisive evidence of facing the right direction. How can I gain the most from trials? There are three key means mentioned in this first chapter of James, verses 2 through 4. Three key means to persevering through, rising above, gaining the most, and winning the victory. First of all, obviously, a joyous attitude, and that's verse 2. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. The word count here means to consider, to evaluate. In other words, you've got to plan this, discipline yourself to do it, make a conscious commitment to count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Paul said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. It didn't come naturally and didn't happen by accident. Just after he says, rejoice always, and again I say rejoice, he makes that statement. And he said it while he was a prisoner. Paul cultivated that contentment. He wasn't just naturally contented. The word fall here, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, is an interesting word. It refers to that which is unplanned or which is a surprise. Remember in the book of Acts where when Paul was on that ship and it fell into a place where two seas came together? A little like hitting a wall in a car when you're on a ship that falls into a place where two seas come together. And it was a surprise, an inadvertent occurrence. There's no way out because these things surround you. You fall in, the door opens, there it is, and now you've got to respond in some way or the other. You weren't looking for it, but you've got to deal with it. Jesus didn't seek trouble, but he certainly accepted it. Hebrews 12:2, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. He looked beyond the trial to the joy to be realized after the trial. In other words, what the enduring of the trial would accomplish, what it would bring. And down in chapter, in same chapter, Hebrews 12:10-11, no chastening for the present time seems to be joyous but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Trials are exercises. They're calisthenics for the spiritual person. So count it a privilege when your faith is being tested. You anticipate what perfecting work can be done through that trial, and you learn to cultivate the right attitude. Jesus said his disciples shouldn't expect anything different than he had endured. If they hated me, they will certainly hate you. If they persecute me, they will persecute you. Look beyond the trial to the joy that will come when you have passed the test. And please note here that the attitude is not one of partial joy, but count it all joy. Not partial joy. Having come to a settled conviction that we're going to face trials with the right attitude. Have you noticed maybe that in your trials you're more aware of God? That maybe you pray more, maybe you study more? Paul was in jail when he said, I do rejoice and will rejoice. Job said, when God has tested me, I will come forth as gold. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And Job's wife is over in the wings saying, why don't you curse God and die? But Job was rejoicing. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glories which shall be revealed in us, Romans 8:18. Almost like the guy who went over and beat his head against the wall just because it felt so good when he stopped. It is going to feel awfully good when it's all over, isn't it? It really is. Now, our values determine our evaluations. If we value comfort more than we value character, trials are going to be terribly upsetting to us. If we value the material more than the spiritual, we're not going to be able to count it all joy. If we live only for the present rather than the future, then trials will make us bitter, not better. If you cannot rejoice in your trials, your values are wrong. That's an awful bitter pill, isn't it? I still have a knot on my tongue. But I still say to you, if you cannot rejoice in your trials, your values are wrong. Pressed out of measure and pressed to all length, pressed so intensely it seems beyond strength, pressed in the body and pressed in the soul, pressed in the mind till the dark surges roll. Pressure by foes and pressure by friends. Pressure on pressure till life nearly ends. Pressed into loving the staff and the rod. Pressed into knowing no helper but God. Pressed into liberty where nothing clings. Pressed into faith for impossible things. Pressed into living a life in the Lord. Pressed into living a Christ life outpoured. Hast thou no scar? No hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee claimed as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archers, spent, leaned me against the tree to die, and rent by ravening beasts that compassed me. I swooned. Hast thou no wound? No wound, no scar? Yes, as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow me, but thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound and no scar? The joy and the privilege of bearing even in our bodies the marks of the Lord Jesus, of enduring trials unto maturity, is one that ought not to be discounted. And a joyous attitude is a real, substantial part of facing trials in a Christian way. Totally contrary to our normal response, like the man on the subway, why me, why this, why now? A joyous attitude is number one. And number two is an understanding mind. A joyous attitude coupled with an understanding mind. Verse 3, the first word is knowing, which speaks of the cognitive function referring to your mind. Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, endurance. That speaks of the mind. Knowing that what's going on in your trials is producing something beneficial. It is producing something beneficial. Know that you're being tested. And the verification of true faith is a very wonderful thing. Don't ever think that trials don't accomplish anything. Just as your labor is not in vain in the Lord, your bearing of trials is not in vain in the Lord. Know that they accomplish something. Knowing this first, that the trying of your faith worketh endurance. The test is not for your bad. The test is for your good. The swimming instructor wants to see you swim. He doesn't want the child to drown, but he wants to see it pass the test, but the child has to go through the test to prove that. The potter doesn't say, let's see how much heat it can take before it cracks. The potter hopes it's not going to crack, and yet it needs to be fired. He looks into the furnace and says, great, it's not cracking. And when the furnace cools down, he lifts it out with great pleasure, and it is approved. I quoted David, who said, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but I didn't quote the rest of it. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers. David actually came to be able to look at Saul as a tool to test him, to teach him. What a wonderful thing. Trials are tools to teach us endurance, staying power, and perseverance. The tenacity of spirit that holds on under pressure. And every time you successfully pass a test, every time you successfully make it through a trial, you are strengthened more. You've gained a little more endurance. Know that, says James. Don't ever doubt it. Know it, that this building of maturity is occurring within you as you succeed. In the 40th Psalm it was written, I waited patiently for the Lord, and He inclined unto me. He heard my cry, brought me out of a horrible pit, out of the miry clay, set my feet on a rock, established my goings, and put a new song in my mouth. Isn't that the way you feel when you know you have come through stronger than ever because of the enduring of that trial? 1 Corinthians 10:13 keeps coming up because it's such a wonderful passage. There's no trial that has taken you but such as is common to man. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that which you are able. Does everyone have the same ability to endure the trials of life? Not at all. A brand new baby Christian wouldn't have the same level that some of us should have. But whoever you are, wherever you are, God will never allow you to face a trial you can't handle. Somebody said, well, God must think I'm a lot stronger than I think I am. Remember, God knows. And remember also that the more difficult the battle, the sweeter the victory. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Why? Because he had respect unto the recompense of reward. Moses had an understanding mind. Knowing this first, he knew it. He knew what enduring the afflictions would bring in the future. He had respect unto the recompense of reward. So he endured the wrath of the king because by faith he saw an invisible king. By faith we have an understanding mind as well. And the third point is a submissive will. Verse 4, word 1. Word 2. Let. The word let indicates submission. Let endurance have its perfect work. First of all, we have a joyous attitude, we have an understanding mind, and then a submissive will. Let endurance do what God wants it to do. And here's a command demanding submission. The only way out of a trial is through it. The only successful way, the only godly way out of a trial is through it. There are no side exits. The way out is through. Psalm 131. Surely I have behaved and quieted myself like a child that is weaned of its mother. My soul is even as a weaned child. The writer says, what I've been through has made me grow. I've matured. I'm off the bottle. Maturity is the goal. Let endurance lead to that, says James. The term for perfect is used in secular sources of animals, which are full grown. It's used here of Christians who are full grown. Now, the statement was made in numerous places. Philippians 3:15, for instance. Therefore, as many of us as be mature. In other words, there were mature people in the first century church, and there are mature people in the church now. It is attainable. You can get there. The Lord is trying to bring us all there. And the word perfect carries the idea of richness of character. Also conveys the idea of a balance, a stable, balanced righteousness. And the word entire, though you may be perfect and entire or complete, lacking nothing. The word entire is the word from which we get our word holography. A holograph is a 360-degree picture, and many of you have seen these. All the portions are intact. Be perfect and holographic. All there. Fully complete, lacking nothing, mature in Christ. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10. The God of all grace, after you have suffered a while, make you perfect. Back in the 48th chapter of the book of Jeremiah, I'll just barely touch this point. There was some strong criticism of Moab back there, and the root of the problem seems to be in verse 11. Moab hath been at ease from his youth. Life had been a bowl of cherries for Moab, and he never grew up. A life without problems produces a very, very weak character. But as we go through trials, we are stripped. Stripped of our worldly dependencies and drawn to God. We are shown the character of our faith. We are perfected into Christ-likeness. Sailors used to say that the crosswinds are best for entering the harbor, because on those little ships, it was very difficult, obviously, to enter the harbor against a headwind. But a tailwind was just as bad, because it could put you 40 feet up on the beach. And so crosswinds were preferred to enter the harbor. We are like good metal. The more we are fired, the more we are refined. The more we are opposed, the more we are approved. Wrongs may try us and even touch us, but they cannot imprint upon us any false stamp. Trials cannot destroy our faith. They do test it, though. The sufferings that we face are like little chips off the cross of Christ. I will not doubt, though all my ships at sea come drifting home with broken mast and sails, I shall believe the hand which never fails from seeming evil worketh good to me. And though I weep because those sails are battered, still will I cry while my best hopes lie shattered, I trust in thee. I will not doubt. Though all my prayers return unanswered from the still white realm above, I shall believe it is an all-wise love which has refused those things for which I yearn. And though at times I cannot keep from grieving, yet the pure ardor of my fixed believing, undimmed, shall burn. I will not doubt. Though sorrows fall like rain and troubles swarm like bees around a hive, I shall believe the heights for which I strive are only reached by anguish and by pain. And though I groan and tremble with my crosses, yet shall I see through my severest losses the greater gain. I will not doubt, well anchored in the faith, like some staunch ship my soul braves every gale. So strong its courage that it will not fail to breast the mighty unknown sea of death. So may I cry when body parts with spirit, I do not doubt. So listening worlds may hear it with my last breath. That's the way to face life, and that's the way to face death, unwaveringly. So let us accept the trials that produce Christ-likeness, that reveal the state of our faith, that humble us, that wean us from the world, that call us to eternal hope, that teach us what we really love, that teach us how to help others, and that chasten us into purity. Let us thank God for such trials and really count it all joy and understand and submit, confident that no trial comes which we can't bear, and knowing that the worth of a soldier is never known in times of peace. God had one son without sin, but he never had a son without a cross. It pleased the Father to bruise his son. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience through the things which he suffered. If this afternoon, in this quiet moment, your conscience points at you and tells you that you have never submitted to Jesus Christ, never given your life to Him, please know that because of His matchless love, He has come to your rescue at the cross. Accept His Son, yield to His will. Hearing the message of God is one thing. Responding to God's message in God's way is another thing entirely. If you're subject to the gospel call today, step out from among the rest. Let us know about your plans for your future with Jesus Christ as we stand together and sing the invitation number.